Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, we like to shake things up since we have three martinis. That's wholly appropriate for our podcast. Normally, we go good, bad, crazy. Today, we'll be going crazy, bad, good. So just when you thought you knew what we were all about here, we throw a little wrinkle your way. Unfortunately, the crazy is nowhere near good. It usually isn't, and that's certainly the case again today. This is actually from the Daily Beast of all places, and they say this, quoting verbatim now, within 24 hours of the 9/11 anniversary attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, U.S. intelligence agencies had strong indications Al-Qaeda-affiliated operatives were behind the attack, and it even pinpointed the location of one of those attackers. Three separate U.S. intelligence officials who spoke to the Daily Beast said the early information was enough to show the attack was planned in the work of Al-Qaeda affiliates operating in eastern Libya. And then they go on to say, nonetheless, it took the White House and the administration until late last week to formally acknowledge what was going on here. And we still even saw the president at the UN just yesterday, Jim, trying to blame it again on the video, when the president of Libya itself saying the video had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Yeah, we begin with kudos to Eli Lake, probably one of the best national security reporters in the business. Fantastic sources. And like, it's kind of interesting when you get surprising news that simultaneously makes sense with your gut suspicions. You know, when there's an attack that kills Americans in the Middle East, your first guess is going to be Al-Qaeda, right? I mean, that doesn't seem, you know, unbelievably shocking. One of the things that's worth noting here is that, you know, Al-Qaeda started out as a group. Some might argue that it's kind of turned into something of a social movement. In other words, you know, there are people all around the Middle East in places like Benghazi, which is one of the cities that apparently sent the most foreign fighters to Iraq during the Iraq War, full of folks who hate America. Are any of these guys, you know, necessarily bin Laden's lieutenants? No, but this is how, you know, these organizations work. This guy knows a guy who trained with this guy, who went to mosque with that guy, and all that kind of stuff. So finding a connection to Al-Qaeda when somebody in the Middle East goes out and kills an American doesn't seem unbelievably hard, particularly in a city like that. Now, what's crazy about it is that this looks like something that, you know, you'd want the administration or any administration would want to put out immediately to say, yes, this was Al-Qaeda, the war on terror continues, and we are going to get these guys. Instead, there's this vague, well, it may have been a target of opportunity. It relates to, I mean, here's the thing. If that YouTube video had never started, the Middle East would still be full of Islamists who want to kill Americans. That YouTube video just provided the excuse. And one of the things that's worth noting when you think about the Islamists in this world, remember, one of bin Laden's original gripes was that there were U.S. troops on Saudi soil after the Persian Gulf War. They left. Bin Laden and the Islamists didn't calm down one iota. For a long time, the argument was the Iraq War has stirred up a hornet's nest among the Islamists. Now, the U.S. troops are out of Iraq, and they're still trying to kill us. They're driven by a broad-based hatred of the West, resentment of its success, resentment of our freedoms, resentment of the fact that we don't live the way they want us to live. And the idea that the administration wants to kind of wave their hands and say, oh, it's all because of this YouTube tape, I can't think of a few things that would be worse than for an administration to lie to the American people about, you know, the causes of terrorism and what's going on here. It's disturbing. It's creepy. It's unnerving. And, you know, this is something that the administration needs to be called out upon time and again.
And one person calling him out on is Mitt Romney. Here's what he had to say in an interview with Fox's Carl Cameron yesterday.
I think they want to do their very best to keep the people of America from understanding exactly what happened. We expect candor. We expect transparency, particularly as it relates to terrorism.
And Jim, you were at the convention in Charlotte when the president said that Al-Qaeda is on the path to defeat and Osama bin Laden is dead. The impression the administration clearly wants to give is because we're out of Iraq and bin Laden is dead, this is no longer a threat. And this flies in the face of that false narrative, and they just have no way around it other than to admit that they were wrong, and they just refuse to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the most fundamental argument here is that Obama's entire approach to dealing with anti-Americanism in the Middle East has basically been proven to be wrong. That you know, you remember Andrew Sullivan writing that Obama's face was the single most effective weapon we had against anti-Americanism because it would change, you know, his middle name is Hussein and he grew up in Indonesia and his half-sister is Muslim and he'd have this remarkable understanding of the Islamic world. And it turns out none of this matters, that really it comes down to differing values and their refusal to live in a world where they live their world their way and we live over in our part of the world our way. They wish to impose their values upon us and are willing to kill us to do it. And that's what it comes down to. And it doesn't, you know, you can't solve that with a pretty speech. You can't, you know, solve that by citing your childhood in Indonesia. And so the entire approach of the administration has been exposed as completely ineffective. And that's a tough thing for a president to be confronting a month or so before Election Day. Yeah. Now, you know, again, I think you exacerbate it when you lie to the public. And I think this is a serious charge, one that Obama really ought to answer for. But to do so, he'd have to do an interview someplace besides The View.
Probably so. Which was interesting, though, because he actually gave a completely different story about what happened in Benghazi to The View than he did the very next day at the UN. So he just does not know what he's trying to sell, or maybe he's just trying to sell different stories to different audiences. I don't know. But anyway, on to martini number two. Now this is the bad one. And if it weren't for the president's refusal to meet with world leaders and some of the comments that he made during his speech yesterday, taking some of the headlines from the time at the UN, Ahmadinejad would certainly be stealing all the headlines. He's still getting plenty, talking about the U.S. being bullied by the Israelis, that it's time to take on the Zionist bullies and all. His usual claptrap on the UN stage. But now we're learning that a number of sources that Iranian military leaders gave details of a new long-range drone and test-fired four anti-ship missiles Tuesday in a prelude to upcoming naval war games planned in an apparent response to U.S.-led warship drills in the Persian Gulf. That's from the Associated Press. And, Jim, these sorts of exercises happen all the time, but when we know that the clock for the Israelis is ticking pretty close, and we know that the nuclear clock in Iran is ticking pretty close to midnight, all of this takes on much more significance.
This strikes me as kind of unnerving news, and here's why. I'm just going to connect a couple of dots here. First, I'm hearing from readers in Israel just anecdotal reports of just the country is increasingly on alert. Military convoys are more visible. Soldiers growing to the wailing wall or weeping wall in Jerusalem and praying before heading off to duty. Nothing, you know, glaringly obvious, but things that just, you know, it seems like the atmosphere in Israel is more tense than usual. The second thing was an interesting column in the Washington Post talked about, I think it was the Brookings Institution, doing kind of a war game scenario between the U.S. and Iran regarding the nuclear program. And basically the result of the war game was that each side thought they were playing it safe and they still ended up in a pretty much all-out military conflict. That basically we are locked into a circumstance in which one little provocation garners a response from the other side, which garners a response from the other side and all that kind of stuff. That this is not something that once the conflict, even a small-scale conflict begins, it is not going to be easy to stop and has a very good chance of spreading and widening pretty considerably. One of the things, examples in this war game scenario was that because they did not like the way the U.S. Navy was rolling around in the Persian Gulf, the folks who were playing the Iranian government were experts on Iran. These are scholars. These are folks who have really studied the Iranian government. They thought that a measured response to the U.S. would be to blow up a resort in Aruba where Americans were vacationing. If the Iranian government really does think that terror overseas is a way to send a subtle message to the United States, it's not that subtle. And I think once that occurs, you're pretty much guaranteeing military conflict with the U.S. So then you put in this latest missile test and this latest talk that they have long-range drones and stuff. Some of this may be bluster on the part of the Iranian military, but some of this probably isn't. And they certainly have no problem doing live-fire exercises with our ships in the neighborhood. And boy, if that doesn't strike you as a formula for trouble, I don't know what does.
Well, on to our third martini now, Jim. And as we mentioned at the outset, the third martini is actually the good martini today. And if you were to poll most celebrities on the presidential race, I think we both know how that would probably turn out. It wouldn't turn out so great for Mitt Romney. But sometimes it's more the quality of the endorser than the quantity of the endorsers. The president may have the Jay-Z's and the Beyoncé's and even the really bizarre endorsements from Madonna that we talked about yesterday. But a couple of really quality people stepping up for Mitt Romney today in Ohio. Jack Nicklaus, the legendary golfer, of course, 18 major championships, still the record. And Mike Rowe, a host of Dirty Jobs. And for those who haven't seen that TV show, he's also featured prominently in Ford commercials and Lee Jean commercials and so forth. So, Jim, looks like Romney's got the white collar and the blue collar spokesman for him there in one of the most pivotal states.
Well, yeah, two things on that. You know, the joke is that, well, Jack Nicklaus locks up the golfer vote for Romney. And maybe that really hurts Obama. Maybe personally, as an avid golfer, it really kind of stings to him to not get Nicklaus. But the bigger deal is Mike Rowe. And Mike Rowe, if folks who haven't seen his show Dirty Jobs, it basically involves him doing all kinds of literally dirty jobs, pig farms and garbage disposal and very complicated construction, oil, every blue-collar job that gets you messy, that involves things that are dangerous and smelly and grit under your fingernails jobs. You know, Mike Rowe does it for a week and just kind of shows people what it's like to do this job. And as a result, he kind of turned into this kind of, you know, quasi-expert on blue-collar employment. And he talked about, he wrote this open letter and he says, look, you know, I'm just going to quote it directly. Our country has become emotionally disconnected from an essential part of our workforce. We are no longer impressed with cheap electricity, paved roads, indoor plumbing. We take our infrastructure for granted and the people who build it. And he says, look, you know, even as employment remains sky high, whole category of vital occupations has fallen out of favor and companies struggle to find workers with the necessary skills. We have embraced a ridiculously narrow view of education. Any kind of training or study that does not come with a four-year degree is now deemed alternative. Basically, the idea that you think about, you know, when Obama goes on and on about his green jobs, et cetera, and they talk about infrastructure spending, well, you need Americans to build the infrastructure. You need folks to be doing the wiring, to doing the plumbing, to doing all the, you know, construction, all these things that are kind of considered, you know, not too long ago were considered good jobs. And the idea that we've kind of gotten this white-collar bias in our jobs and this notion that we discourage kids from pursuing what can be quite lucrative careers in you know, getting your hands dirty, I think it's a message that's really going to resonate. I think it's really going to resonate in a place like Ohio. And Roe said he wrote a very similar letter to Obama 4 years ago and never got a response. Well, not only did Romney respond, but he must have done something. You know, the response must have been good enough to persuade Mike Roe to come out and endorse him in Ohio. So if you're struggling, if you're worried about the future of this economy, if you're get this feeling that you've kind of been disregarded and that society looks down on you for not having a, you know, office job, boy, you know, one that, you know, this probably is a key demographic in Ohio, and I can't think of anybody who's got more credibility with this demographic than Mike Rowe. So him coming out and saying, look, Mike, you know, Mitt Romney's the guy who can fix this. Mitt Romney's the guy who can actually get this country working again. Boy, I can't think of a better messenger for that message than Mike Rowe. I don't know if this is a game changer in Ohio. The numbers there have been looking a little ominous for Romney for a while, but this can only be good news. And I bet you, I wouldn't be surprised if you see Mike Rowe in ads and doing robocalls. And if I'm the Romney campaign, I exploit him as much as I possibly can. Now, of course, somebody's going to say, Jim Garrity calls on Mitt Romney to exploit Mike Rowe. but the more interesting is that, look, this is a potentially very useful and very credible messenger in the state of Ohio and all the, you know, the upper Midwest and, you know, your Wisconsins, your Pennsylvanias, Iowas, places like that. And look, I mean, you know, already on Twitter this morning, my buddy Cam Edwards has joked Mike Rowe for labor secretary. And boy, oh boy, it might not be a bad idea to have a labor secretary, have people in government who actually know how to do some of these jobs, huh, Greg?
Yeah, that would help. And I agree. This could be an endorsement that actually connects with people, at least until the Nicki Minaj endorsement becomes official. Then Mitt Romney will really be on the path of victory.
Sounds good to me.
Jim, have a great day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg. Bye.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today, and don't forget to join us again on Thursday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.